Hello and welcome to the Becky Book Show. I'm so glad that you joined us today for our program. My name is Dr. Robin Gould, and I'm going to be your host over the next hour and a half or so as we talk about the things that are important in our lives from the perspective of the Becky Book authors. I am here to represent all of the authors and speak of the cries of their hearts as well, as we do stand in solidarity with what our goal is with Becky Books. So if you're new to the program, I'll tell you a little bit about myself and I'll tell you a little bit about Becky Books. I am a marriage and family therapist, and I have a doctoral degree in religious education. And my specialty is attachment theory. I work with people with attachment needs. And I love being in that field. I love doing that work. It's, I think, the most exciting work and the most rewarding work that I believe anyone can do. Certainly not qualifying anyone as more important than other people, but I do feel privileged and honored to be investing time and being a part of people's attachment journeys with each other, with the Father, and even on some level with themselves, to accept themselves in the proper way. So I have really found that to be a very rewarding career. Really enjoyed it. I cannot separate it from any of the Torah work and teaching and learning that I do, because it's all about attachment between the Father and his children. So it's very exciting, and it just segues really nicely into all of the work of the Becky Books. So let me start with a little information about the Becky Books. Becky, B-E-K-Y, it stands for Building and Encouraging the Kingdom of Yeshua. And these books are perfectly designed for what our topic is about today. Our topic today, before I tell you about the Becky Books, I want to mention our topic because I want you to see the connection here. We're going to discuss the Mussar principle of compassion. So if you're not familiar with Mussar are spiritual principles, and they're actually specifically Jewish ethics. So the book that I use to study and share this with people is called Everyday Holiness, the Jewish Spiritual Path of Mussar. It's written by an excellent author named Alan Moranis, who's actually the founder of the Mussar Institute. And his book is excellent, and I recommend it for anyone interested in taking their faith to that next level and who is interested in something that's so simple and profound and is to be read and reread over and over. I find this book is sort of the well that just keeps giving. Every time I dip my pail in, I'm getting fresh water. Even if I've read that particular principle before, we are constantly evolving organism in terms of our spiritual walk. So we've never really reached the bottom of where we are. And that's what's so nice about Mussar, is that it never quite gets old. Absolutely. On the contrary, in fact, it's fresh and new every time I go through it. So today I'm talking about compassion. So I'm linking this together with the Becky Books very specifically, because the Becky Books are designed as compassion. That was actually the whole idea of compassion, is the basis from which the Becky Books came. It's the foundation for Becky Books. It was a need we saw and decided to fill. So Becky, B-E-K-Y, stands for Building and Encouraging the Kingdom of Yeshua. And so building, right? So having resources to build the kingdom. Part of building a kingdom is structures, right? Structures that come together as a kingdom and work together and provide refuge and purpose. And people are structures, and we are to build structures, right? We are to build people up. And the Becky Books are designed to build people up. They're books that are very informative. They're very inexpensive. They're very readily available. You can buy them on Amazon or on the websites of the authors that sell them, that wrote them. But they're designed very specifically to encourage people, to build people up. They're designed to be informative in that a person might not, let me just use one of my books, for example. I wrote a book called Peter's Vision, Beacon or Bacon. And that book, very specifically, is about Peter's vision. And many people have read Peter's vision many times. They've sat in Sunday school, they've heard the story, they've read the story, and generally think they understand the story, when many, many times they haven't actually read specifically the words of the story. They've read the story through an impression and through a theology. So the words tend to match the theology rather than people actually reading the words. So the book, in a very kind and non-judgmental, non-snarky tone, goes through the vision. It even goes deeper and takes you on a couple of rabbi trails there to give you a little bit more information, to teach you how to study in a really non-condescending way to help the people that you come in contact with that might have questions about your faith or how you see Peter's vision. They are not quite sure about it. This is a resource for you to hand to them in a way that's non-threatening, non-judgmental. It's kind, they're affordable, they're easy to get your hands on, and people really enjoy them. They're short, they can be read in pretty much one setting. It depends on the book, one sitting, I guess I would say. But then some are not quite as cut and dry as I think Peter's vision is. But these books are designed to compassionately be an outreach and a kind way to build and encourage the kingdom and to provide resources for you so that you're not always having to recreate the wheel constantly, you know, having to start from scratch. Here's a resource you can hand out and say, hey, on your own time, if you desire, prefer to, here's something you can check out. And it really also helps people who have read, like just for example, this one book I'm mentioning about Peter's vision. It helps them save face in their own world because it can be very unsettling to know, wow, I really didn't understand that all those years. And here's information that's very credible and referenced. And here I am learning something. But you get to do that in your own private way. And I think sometimes that's what people need. They need time alone with the Father to just kind of process their thoughts and to work through the material. And so they're designed to be compassionate to the other person and then also to you, to help us not, you know, always be in a state of compromise with our relationships, always trying to make sure we set everything exactly right or set aside enough time for everybody. I mean, generally in our lives when we're busy and we have a lot of things going on, it can be very difficult to do that. So we really felt like this was a need to have these short, easy to share books for people to read. And so when I'm combining this today with the spiritual ethic of the Musar principle of compassion, this very much segues into that. And you'll find other Becky books. I wrote books about the dietary laws and one about marriage and remarriage and divorce in the Bible, which is a really great book. I really recommend you get that. It's very informative. But there's also a Becky book on how to celebrate the new moon. It doesn't talk about identifying the new moon or anything like that. It doesn't get into anything divisive. These books are designed to help reduce divisiveness. You have a Becky book, What is the Torah? And about what the Messianic service looks like, the Jewish sources, the Hebrew calendar, the Sabbath. These are all topics that are just so important for people to understand. There's even a book that's called Truth, Tradition, or Tear. I highly recommend that one, where it talks about tradition and what's good and how can you tell and what does tradition mean and what to know, what's a good tradition and what's a not as good tradition or what's a tear, right? This book helps people understand that. There's one about Hanukkah and prophecy. It's a very excellent book, and that's at least a two sitting book, I would say. Because it takes a minute to get through that material. So that would be more of our upper tier books. But I really encourage you to just kind of log on to Amazon, look at what's there, and see if any of these books will help you. I've written Colossal Controversies, First Century Words Revealed to 21st Century Believers, Peter's Vision, and of course the divorce book. And that pretty much carpet bombs the dietary law arguments. In a really friendly way. So having said all that and introduced myself and what the Becky books are, let's get started with our topic today. And our topic today, again, is compassion. This is a very, very important Musar principle. This is a central facet to Judaism in general. Very, very important from a Torah perspective that we understand compassion. So let's start here. We have got, look, I'm actually in the book, again, Everyday Holiness, the Jewish Spiritual Path of Lusar by Alan Moranis. So if you can ever get your hands on that book, which it's easy to get, I would recommend it. And here's what compassion, rachamim, this is what it says. It says, kindness, empathy, and care arise from standing so close, feeling what the other feels. And just that one sentence, kindness, empathy, and care arise from standing so close, feeling what the other feels. That is an enormous sentence right there, and an enormous groundbreaking principle for you to understand relationship. From an attachment perspective, that is the foundation for attachment. And actually, let me read on just a little bit, and we're going to go a little bit deeper with this. I'm going to share a little bit about the work that I do, because I feel like it's really beneficial to kind of giving a tangible example for what this looks like. So I'm quoting Orchot Tzadikim, which is actually in the book here of Everyday Holiness. And I want to quote this, and I quote, compassion is an extremely noble trait. It is one of the 13 traits attributed to the Holy One, blessed is He, as it is written, compassionate and gracious. All that one can do in cultivating this trait, he should exert himself to do. Just as one would want compassion in his time of need, so one should have compassion on others who are in need. And I'll go on, and here's what the book says. It says, the moral precepts of Judaism demand that we be compassionate to every soul. Singled out repeatedly as especially needing our compassion are the poor, widows, orphans, and others in need. The Torah repeatedly hammers away at our obligation to help those who are vulnerable and needy. The tradition is so insistent that we be living vessels of compassion that the Talmud asserts that, and I quote, anyone who is not compassionate with people is certainly not a descendant of our forefather Abraham, unquote. It goes on to say that the Hebrew term for compassion, rachamim, shares its linguistic root with the word rachem, which means womb. That compassion is somehow connected to motherhood has led many commenters to link this soul trait to the emotional bond of mother to child. Compassion is seen to be the embodiment of the strong ties of love, kinship, and tenderness a mother feels for the baby she carries within her. I think that is really interesting because when you think of the parent-child relationship, clearly that draws on attachment, right? Because clearly a mother and her child are attached. Here is the quote here by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, and here's what he says, and I quote, compassion is the feeling of empathy, which the pain of one being of itself awakens in another, and a higher and more human. And the higher and more human the beings are, the more keenly attuned they are to re-echo the note of suffering, which, like a voice from heaven, penetrates the heart. So let me just read that one more time. Compassion is the feeling of empathy, which the pain of one being of itself awakens in another. And the higher and more human the beings are, the more keenly attuned they are to re-echo the note of suffering, which, like a voice from heaven, penetrates the heart. So here is a major foundation compassion is with attachment. So feeling another person's pain, standing so close that you can feel the suffering of another person. Empathy, right? It's where you can connect with something in yourself that relates to that feeling, to that experience that the other is going through, compassion, right? So in many ways, we know that our Messiah walked our walk, And he walked our life and he walked our dusty roads. And his back ached and his eyes cried. And he was hungry and he was thirsty and he suffered. And there's a great deal of compassion that he had in love for us. And we, in many ways, identify with his brokenness. And we can really relate to that piece of his walk, that we deal with pain. We've been shamed. You know, we've had these issues that he chose to embed himself in and experience. And so in the work that I do, compassion, right? So attachment, that's really the central focus of connection. Very important to understand about connection. And when people can be connected, it says in the Bible that love covers a multitude of sins. There's so much to say about that. There's so much that we can rise up against in judgment when we fail to stand close, and when we fail to feel, and we fail to look, and we fail to listen. And that's one of the biggest problems I'll see in a lot of the couples work that I'll do with people, is if they don't want to listen, they only want to respond. You've probably heard people talk about how important it is to listen, to hear, and not to respond. That actually cannot be emphasized strongly enough. And when I do work with people, I have to set parameters. And I have to engage in a relationship with the people I work with that's safe and provides safety for them, that they can feel safe in investing their emotions in their time and their vulnerability into these sessions that we do together, so that they can find connection and find healing. And so if we are listening to a person, so if you're talking to a friend, let's say, and they're sharing about an experience that they are struggling with, right? So number one, you have a friend, you have a person that's dignified your relationship high because they have invested with their vulnerability. They're sharing with you something that they struggle with. If we can really absorb the profound impact that should have on our relationship, just the fact that someone is sharing, oftentimes we miss that. We don't realize that we are being given a very profound gift, which is the gift of trust. Obviously, that person sees something in you that they trust enough to reveal a vulnerability that they're going through. So don't miss that. Don't get lost in listening to them through a filter of your own and think, it's hard for me to appreciate this person's struggle because it seems like nothing compared to mine. If you've ever heard yourself say that, please back up. Close that part of yourself off, because that part of you is loud. And the quiet part of you needs to listen. There's number one, a person, the other end of this conversation, who's needy, broken, and sharing. You at the other end are a person who can learn something, and a person who can respond to that person based on their experience, and not necessarily your advice, and definitely not your advice. So when I'm working with people, one of the hardest things is many people haven't been in relationships that have been very conducive to basically having the freedom or the presence of mind or the ability to explore their emotions, to explore their experiences, and to form an opinion on even how they feel about certain things. They're very shut down. They are very reactionary, but not so much exploratory. And so when you're not in a place where you're safe to explore, you're going to basically have a couple go-to emotions, which is usually either shut down or anger. And usually people will vacillate between the two. If you ever do any research into psychology, you'll learn about the experiment called the strange situation. And without going into a lot of detail, just in a nutshell, it was about attachment. And it showed that non-present, disengaged mothers that had had reasons for disengagement, maybe they had postpartum depression or whatever, that when their children were in the room with the toys, those children would only sit on their mom's lap or they would completely disengage from the mom. They were either overly attached and connected, or they were under attached and connected. But the children that had mothers that were engaged and connected, where the child felt like the mom's presence was consistent and trustworthy, they were able to explore the toys. And there's more to that study, and I just gave you such a brief overview. But it's such a profound piece of information in the way that we are, right? We think about it. Just think about it. It's a running thread through all of your relationships, where if there's room in the relationship, where there's a dependable friend, there's room for that person to explore their inner and outer world with you. And many times that people, you know, verbally process and they're listening to it through the loving ears of their friend, they might hear something through your loving ears that they didn't even hear through their own because they had so much self-judgment. Or sometimes, you know, you can royally screw that up and not be there for your friend and respond to what they share with, you know, overreaching advice or judgment or comparisons. Comparisons are one of the ugliest things because you really cannot compare people. You cannot compare experiences. We can't look at another person's journey and compare it with our own. We can explore our own relationship to that issue. And if it's for the benefit of that other person and for the benefit of the relationship, we can say, yes, I can relate to that because X, Y, and Z. And give your reasons to bond and to connect over that issue. But not if you're one-upping that person. That is not compassion. Compassion is standing so close you can feel the suffering. That's where you've gotten into that pit with that person and you're in the dark with them, right? You can feel that and they're not alone. That's the piece that is central to the idea of compassion. And the whole idea of a womb, right? A safe, protected environment where the mother and the child are so connected. And you think about the way a mother is ideally to be with her child, which is they feel everything, every movement. And when that child's born, that mother is so in tune with the needs of that child. They would do anything to investigate the facial expressions and the sounds of the baby's cries because they want to hear and they want to know what the needs are and then they want to meet the needs. So typically I do this with, you know, marriage counseling, where you have couples that are so well-intentioned and they desire a deep intimacy and a deep connection with each other, but they have not ever learned to listen to their spouse or even to themselves. And that is one of the most rewarding parts of my job, is to help people to realize that they have not really fully explored their own responses to their relationships. So they haven't given their partner enough information about them to make an informed decision on how to respond. So we have to go through this very slowly, and we have to create a safe space for the couples to be able to reach in and bring this out. And the other partner is well briefed on listening, right? Standing really close and listening and just being in the experience of their partner and not from their own perspective. And this can take work. This doesn't happen in 1 week. It's very common that one of the partners is even maybe shaking their head while the other person's talking because they're not really listening. They are judging, right? They're they're so aware that they're thinking that the other person doesn't get it. They're wrong. They don't know what they're really saying. Rather than being in the moment with their partner, appreciating the vulnerability they're sharing and standing really close so that they can hear. And they're missing out because they're not getting information that they need. Really need information. So that's really the crux of attachment work. That's what I do. And it's exciting to believe me, compassion is the most exciting thing. It sounds like, you know, a Sunday sermon that might bore you, but let me tell you, compassion brings people to life. It actually brings people to life. I want to read you this from Everyday Holiness. It says, and I quote, "In a psalm we read, as a father has compassion on his children, so God has compassion for those who are in awe of him," unquote. This single line of scripture gives us two additional points to note about compassion. Not only is compassion a quality that is somehow related to a mother and the child of her womb. Here, it is set out in an image of a father-child relationship. In addition, compassion is portrayed as a divine quality exhibited by God, who crowns you with loving kindness and tender compassion. Wow, so compassion is really raised as a divine quality that the Father himself possesses. It says he has compassion for those who are in awe of him. So many people will find from mainstream circles that they've been really taught about an always angry God. Always angry. You're never good enough. You're always steeped in sin. You're always someone he sees as needing correction. And intimacy does not grow in the presence of fear when you're always in fear. This is in awe. Being in awe of him, right? Why would we need to fear him? Why would we? Well, let me just give you an idea. Personally, I think it's so that we know we can trust him. When we know that he is the all-powerful one, he is the one we have awe for. He is the one we fear because his reactionary presence impacts the universe and is the universe. We can trust that this God is capable to handle us. And if he says he loves us, he doesn't lie. We can trust him. We can trust a God that we fear. It is not that we fear him so we can't trust him. It's the complete opposite. From a Hebraic perspective, this fear is about trust and belief and faith in who he is and his power, and not in him as the mean judge against us. Many people have been taught that God is out to judge and to punish and to torture people who don't desire a relationship with him. Personally, I would counter that he is not so going to punish people who don't want a relationship with him. He is out to seek for the ones who do. His goal is to seek for the ones who do want to covenant with him. His obsession is not those who ignore him or reject him. His obsession is the bride that left Egypt to be with him. The beautiful bride that he could impress and deliver, that's his goal. If you're that person, that makes you his goal. And if you fear him, it's because you can trust him. He understands that you're not fully back to factory settings. You're not there. You're in a journey with him. And he is investing in you to restore you, to restore your heart, your soul, your life, to restore back to you all that the locusts have eaten away. That's what his business is. It's not to torture people who don't like him. Though as a loving father, he will come against those who hurt his own. Just like we as parents would do with our own children, or even just with our friends. We see, just have you ever been in that situation? Let's say you're not a parent, maybe you're just a college student or someone who's never had children, and you have a friend that you care about, and you mutually invest in your relationship, and they mean something to you. And they come and they tell you a story about somebody who wounded them and shamed them and hurt them. You're going to be probably pretty highly reactionary toward that, right? That's going to anger you and hurt you. Because you're standing so close to the one you love, you can feel the pain as they're describing how ashamed they were or how broken it made them. And you'll have all kinds of things to say, right? Well, that's just an example, I believe, implanted in us and our feelings that is like the image of God. He has his reaction. He has his emotions. He's standing so close that he knows, right? So compassion is something that he has planted in us to share with him, that we can relate. I can relate on some level with the creator of the universe when he is angry at someone who has hurt his child. It says if you touch Israel, you're touching his eye, the center of his eye. Think of something's in the center of your eye. Ouch. It's not where you want to be touched. You have such a very visceral response to anything with the eye. That's very interesting. So compassion's exciting. Compassion is restorative and it's divine. Let me read again from the book here. It says that God is seen to be compassionate is fundamental to a Jewish view of the divine. The high point of the closing prayers on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, is the recitation of the 13 divine attributes of compassion of God. This is also the central refrain of the forgiveness prayers that are repeated periodically throughout the year. When you do these 13 attributes of compassion that we invoke on Yom Kippur, and in these special prayers make their appearance in the Torah, they show up in the immediate aftermath to the sin of the Israelites building a golden calf to worship when Moses successfully pleads with God not to wipe out his people who have sinned, but instead to be compassionate and forgiving. So it is appropriate that we, too, call on the compassion of God as we confess our own weaknesses and transgressions, unquote. So when we think about God was able to generate compassion for the people that were actually worshiping a golden calf. There's many different theories about the golden calf and what this means and what they were doing. There are some people that think that they were, because it was a feast day on the calendar, God's calendar, they think that they were worshiping him through a symbol they knew from Egypt, which is unacceptable, but something they were doing. Some people think they were actually worshiping the calf itself as a false god. So I don't know what camp you are in, pun intended there. This is the camp of the Israelites. But if you let go of that argument and you can just see the point being made there is about compassion. So God was standing near. Moses did appeal to God. Confusing to a lot of people. Did God change his mind? Was he going to do something that Moses talked him out of? Well, this leaves a lot of room for people to fight about and argue and sort of get confused about who God is, and is he the decisive judge who knows all and is perfect? Absolutely. But here, in this story, it's demonstrated to us that there was a dialogue between God and man. And as God listened, I don't believe he changed his mind. I believe he was teaching Moses compassion. By setting Moses up, right? Setting Moses up to tell God why he should be compassionate. This is not to teach God anything or to change anything about what he was going to do. But this is about a teaching moment for Moses, which means it's a teaching moment for us. I believe that God knew the pain these people were in. They had been led in spiritual darkness and enslavement for so long. There's so much they didn't know. They'd been through so many traumatic experiences, and they were used to this Egyptian way of life where all these gods were tangible, realistic aspects of their regular life that they felt they could experience with their eyes and touching them, you know. And that's why the plagues were all about God showing that each one of these gods that they worshipped, that he was way above these little g gods, right? You had the Most High God. So compassion was something that he was teaching Moses, and Moses was learning it as he went, as he verbally processed. Of course, Moses is so angry at first, but as he appeals to God, he himself is verbally processing and coming to a conclusion. Please have mercy on these people. So many times when we read the Bible, we have to understand, if our God knows all and is all, and he is, why does the story read like it does? Who has got something to learn? Well, clearly man. So read the story from the perspective standing near the man. And what would he need to know by the one who knows everything? And how might be the lesson taught, be taught? Well, in this case, it was verbally processing it. The more Moses talked, the more he himself understood what needed to be done. The more he narrated, the more compassion came. That's why the sessions that I have with couples are so dynamic and exciting. Because you can see a person verbally processing and kind of coming to life. They're able to explore their experience in the presence of a safe place to land with each sort of piece of conclusion that they come to as they talk. Compassion is an opportunity for you to demonstrate the image of God to another person. It is no small thing. Don't shrink from this opportunity, my friends. Take that moment. If you can't fully be present with someone in that moment, set a time when you can be. And if it's a pocket of 5 minutes you have, give it. Because when compassion knocks on your door, the more you give it, the more you will understand it, and the less the world will hurt you. When you understand the trials of another person, let me tell you something, you learn how to not be rejected. You learn that everything isn't about you having problems and being unlikable. It's about people being broken and wounded and not handling it well, coping falsely, like Adam and Hawa in the garden did. They hid from God. They covered themselves with their own fig leaves that they put together. They didn't run to their father for repair and restoration and forgiveness. They hid. So when compassion comes to you in the form of a friend or your spouse or your child or someone you work with, set your pen down, put your clipboard down, put your phone down, and answer the call, just like Moses. And as you go through with this person, and you're just focusing on this person, you're not thinking about yourself, you're walking along this path with them. They're painting a picture of this path, and you're walking along this path, and you can hear this person's heart. You can feel their struggle, and you're there with them. They're not alone. You've joined with them. There's an attachment between the two of you, and only for a few minutes. This is how connection happens, my friends, is when we are quiet and still and standing close. It's a privilege and it's an honor. I can honestly tell you that every session that I finish with anyone that I work with, I feel so honored that in my presence, an alliance is formed and a trust is developed between me and them. And they share and they feel safe. And there's a truth about what they're saying. And maybe they didn't even think it had the right to be true. But in the presence of our work together, it has the right to be true. It doesn't mean we want to stay in these stuck places, but it means that our emotions are our teachers. And we need to listen. And that honor and that privilege is not lost on me. I'm always moved by the bravery and the courageous investment of people that I work with. It's incredible. It's nothing I take for granted. I don't want you to take it for granted when it comes around to you. If you're a husband and your wife is struggling with something and you want to fix it, and that's understandable, you want to repair things. Sometimes your role, many times, most of the time, is not to fix a person. God fixes everyone. But sometimes we just need a partner in that dark pit. And we sit and we stop and we listen and we hear. And maybe we even experience with them. Whatever it is that they're sharing, maybe they felt lonely at work. Maybe they felt they weren't valued. Maybe they felt hurt by a friend. Maybe they feel confused about the way they're handling finances. Maybe they're worried about if they're a good mom. Whatever it is that somebody is honoring you with, whatever this information is that you're being honored with and trusted with, don't stamp on those flowers. You know what? Receive. And just be there. Just be there. If they ask for advice, carefully give it. Tenderly offer a gentle word of encouragement or a powerful word of inspiration, whatever that moment calls for, you'll know. But wait to be asked. And be aware that this person has singled you out, set apart their feelings to be open to you, so you can be open to them. You can reflect back to them what you hear them saying. That's a very powerful part of the work I do, is to be able to reflect back to somebody what they're saying to me. These powerful words that they're saying about their experience and what they're going through. And there's an amazing transformation that people go through where they've held everything in and all of a sudden they're talking about it with somebody who accepts them. And then they allow themselves to feel it and they go to that place of feeling. Oh, it's like a huge exhale. And there's all kinds of different reactions that people have. And I don't rush in to stop that experience. I want those words to linger in the air so that people can walk in the light. And what does it mean to walk in the light? Because that's a big part of compassion. The light is, it is what it is. You've heard that expression before. It is what it is. Well, that is the ultimate true sentence. We might not want something to be a certain way, but that's an illusion because it's not what we want, it's what it is. And if a person is in a certain experience and they feel a certain way, that is what it is. That doesn't mean that's not going to change as that person develops and learns and matures and is able to bravely step out to that next level of risk to maybe get out of that rut that they're in. But that's part of their journey. It's not for us to judge when that happens. Though as friends and partners and family, it is our duty and our job to call each other out into the light. And we can be a part of that process where we recognize a person has shrunk back from what they really need to do. And in love and in caring, we can invest in them in that way. Because compassion is exciting. Compassion is a part of living fully and without fear. I absolutely love how this is worded in the book. It says, and I quote, "We'll need to look more closely at how compassion shows up in relationships. But before we do that, we need to investigate whether compassion is indeed an emotion, as Rabbi Hirsch and others describe it to us. Is compassion simply the kind of empathetic feeling a parent has for a beloved child, in which we hope and pray God has for us, who are like children of the divine? When we look at one further way in which the term rachamim is frequently put to use in Jewish tradition, we will have to call into question the idea that compassion is an emotion. So is compassion an emotion? I'm going to say compassion is an action, because it requires us to go against, and this is my words here, it requires us to go against judgment, which is in our nature, right? Being the judge is one of the ways that we've covered up our own shame. Being the judge. But really, truly, who is the judge? It is God himself. It's not us. We are not the judge. We are not qualified to judge. But many times, that's what we do, because we don't know the number of hairs on everyone else's head. So one of the ways we've covered up feeling like we're not in control is we become the judge. Because Adam and Chava wanted to be like God. They didn't want to be human the way he had created them. They wanted to be like him. So they were really encroaching on his territory rather than just letting him be God and they be human. And so judgment is something that needs to be suspended and obliterated to truly walk in the light yourself, because it's an illusion that we have the qualities to judge. Now, I'm not saying this as a black and white statement. So clearly, if someone's hurting a child or committing a crime, I mean, we judge these things very righteously, that these are wrong things. But as far as a man's heart, right, that's going to be between them and the Almighty. And that's where we walk in building and encouraging. That's where we provide Becky books, right? This is where we have tools. We have friends. We have resources that we can hand people to help them out of whatever they're going through. I can't tell you how many people will just fight and argue over the dietary laws. It's one of the biggest discussions I will have with people. Because for some reason, food just resonates with people. The idea of God telling them not to eat something that other people are eating, it can really confuse people. Of course, I always present it the way I believe it to be. It's a relational aspect. It's the Father who gives you the keys to the kingdom that he created and tells you how to eat within that creation. It's a relational parenthood thing that we trust. We don't always know the reasons. I think the ecosystem speaks pretty loud and clear as to some of the reasons, but it doesn't say that in his word anywhere. This is a matter of faith and trust and obedience. So the dietary laws are just one of these things. Now, when people talk to me about it and they're like, no, I just really don't believe that this is really relevant to me and they're going through all this, they very much expect me to be hard on them and to judge them, to be very harsh, and I'm not harsh. And I share with them, well, this is what I've studied and what I see and what I read. And you'll do what you think is right. You know, it's not for me to tell them what to do. Well, this sort of freedom is a little unsettling to people. They're used to being judged very harshly. Where I'm not in that role, I might be a vessel of information that I have vetted carefully. And the dietary laws is one of those things that it's very easy to prove. But a person's heart doesn't always arrive with their brain, right? With the knowledge. You can have a Vietnam vet that's going to jump every time they hear a car backfire because their brains aren't going to catch up with, they have an automatic reaction. Well, people are like that with food and with other issues that they felt like they had, you know, very concrete conclusions on that were challenging with this whole Torah. And it can really challenge their relationship, the feeling of the security of the relationship. So I make it a point to explain to them that the Father is not rejecting them. He is inviting them deeper into the sanctuary deeper under his wing of protection by living his way. That this change that they'll enact in their life to be obedient to these scriptures are a way of being his child and being loved and not being restricted. You're not being restricted. You're being parented. You're being pointed the way. You're guided. You're directed. So it's not about food. It's about love. It's about trust. It's about faith. So when you think about compassion, these are inextricably linked facets to compassion. And I think this book, Everyday Holiness, has a really wonderful grasp in a very simple way about how they bring this up. Like here it says, we are told that God realized that the world, and especially people, would not survive if the world were set up so that strict justice was exacted instantly for every error or wrongdoing. A world run only according to the principle of stern justice would leave no room for free will, learning, change, or growth. Because every single time you did something wrong, mechanical rules would mete out results instantly or without variation. To forestall such insufferable rigidity, God included the attribute of compassion as an essential feature of creation right alongside judgment. I mean, what a powerful lesson right there. There's room for growth. There's room for mistakes. There's room for errors in your relationships and in your marriages. Leave room for your partner to say it wrong and to do it wrong and to screw it up and come back having learned. Leave room for that for each other. Allow room in your conversation for that person to not exactly know what they're saying, and let them get there without attacking on technicalities. We are never going to fall in love with each other deeper because of a technicality. It's always going to be because of a warm moment that defied all the odds of technicalities. It's despite the technicalities that we find love. I firmly believe that with all of my heart. It says here, and I'm reading from Everyday Holiness, and I quote, "Compassion is so fundamental to the world that the Talmud says it is one of the 10 elements through which the world was created. The mystical tradition in Judaism has picked up on this depiction, and so it comes down to us that Rachamim is one of the 10 primary emanations that underlie all of ongoing existence in the universe. Compassion is the meeting and balancing point for the channels that break down loving kindness on the one hand and strict judgment on the other. Compassion blends these energies and so achieves and promotes balance between the necessarily hard and rigid and the equally necessary soft and caring." End quote. That's far from just being an emotion. And that's such an important piece to remember. In the formation of all creation, compassion is sewn in as a thread to hold that fabric together. I think that's exciting. It says here in this book, and I quote, "All these teachings from tradition lead us to the conclusion that compassion is not what it may have seemed at first, the emotion a mother feels for the child she carries in her womb. If not that, then how are we to understand compassion?" It goes on to talk about close identity. I really hope you get this book and read this very, very carefully, because compassion, as it says in this book, is an inner quality that grows within us out of the perception that we are not really separate from the other. That's a huge, groundbreaking idea. If I had 3 hours, we could actually discuss compassion a little bit better. I'm trying to condense it in about an hour and a half here for you. But even though these chapters are not long, each sentence is a meaty meal. It really is a meaty, meaty meal. But the whole idea of connectedness, the whole idea of us being connected, well, we're family, right? Family is family. You might not know each other very well, and you might disagree on some issue, but we're family. And the idea is how maybe we as parents might see the way we, or even if we have dogs, right? We want our dogs to get along. We think it's cute when even our dogs, like, I know people with 2 dogs, and they have the funniest, cutest stories about their dogs. They call them their kids. And they'll talk about how one dog did this and the other did this. I mean, it's adorable. But that's even in that realm, the connectedness of organisms, and how there's an interplay between how things, when they're concordant, is wonderful. And that's how we are with our children, right? We want our children to have each other's backs and to help each other and to encourage each other not to make the bad choices and to stay in the good choices and to stand in the gap when the person is trying to make a choice or had made the wrong choice. That's where compassion comes in. And when we think about it, have you ever had a prayer? Have you ever prayed like this where you have compassion on people, but you just haven't had it on yourself? Because you've made a really wrong choice, and it seems like the consequences are beyond what you can face. You know, it does say that the Father never, you know, will bring any more upon us than what we can handle, but we certainly can bring upon ourselves more than we can handle. And I can speak from personal experience that I've had that prayer, where I've said, I have brought upon my life consequences that defy my limits. And I need a supernatural amount of compassion. And I need you to give it to me for myself first, so I even dare to pray that I can ask for it. And then he reminds me that if I'm to love my neighbor as myself, and I would have compassion for my neighbor, then I can allow that compassion for myself. And he does have compassion. It doesn't free me always or hardly ever from my consequences. But it certainly can strengthen me so that I can face them, as hard as they might be. That's compassion. That's the compassion the Father has for me, and the compassion he's teaching me to have for others and even myself. Because it's to be embedded, period, as a principle by which we live our lives. The way that we live our lives should be compassionate. We shouldn't just be compassionate between 7 and 8 during a difficult conversation. It should be a part of our identity that we stand so close we can feel. Can you do that? Is that something that you can do? If you can't, be honest and add that in your prayer life, that your compassion level would be raised so that you would be more in the image of the Father. You'd be more in his image. Look for opportunities in your life to demonstrate compassion, to feel compassion, to be challenged to provide it. This isn't always going to be easy. In fact, maybe it's never easy. But if you ever had that moment, I don't know if you have ever experienced this, but have you ever been like in the grocery store and you see like this elderly man? This happens to me all the time because I am so crazy about elderly people. I just feel like they have been through so much and they have just kept going. And I look at them and they become more vulnerable and frail as they get older. And I just feel very connected, and I have a lot of compassion for the elderly. And so I remember one time I was 12 years old and I was in this little grocery store. And this little old man, he was buying a couple little items. One of them was like a pain reducer, like a headache pill for his wife. And the clerk was running him through. She didn't have any time for like this person who was a little bit slower than the average person. And he was saying, you know, just basically saying he had to get this headache reduced, pain reducer. And I remember he said it, and I remember the clerk just like brushing him off. And I remember even at age 12, I remember just looking at that and thinking how, wow, that is so wrong. Wait a minute, stop. What does it take for you to say, well, that's good that you're getting these for her. I hope they help. That's all it would take. And I remember I just felt like crying. I just had this moment of compassion, and I thought, I bet that's how God feels. In his emotional world, which he has deep emotions, he felt for this man. He had loved this man throughout his life. And here's with someone just kind of rushing him through, didn't care. There wasn't even anyone behind me. There was no reason for it. And I'm not really, who knows what that clerk went through that day. You know, I need maybe to develop and generate some compassion for that person. Like maybe they had had a horrific day. Maybe this person reminded them of their grandfather who had passed away a month before and they were struggling with that. I don't know. Who knows? I just remember at 12 being aware of how powerful compassion could be. In a very small moment. And the small moments are what really comprise our lives. I think that's something that we learned from. Last week we talked about huga, which is a feeling of being and being present and experiencing and enjoying these small moments, which really are the big moments. And anyway, it was something that we talked about. We applied it last week to the feasts, and I called it spiritual huga, which is just an idea to apply to the feasts and how to fully enjoy and be present with others. And I think that's the thread that really leads through with compassion, is just stopping, slowing down, and having an experience. And when we're close to people, when we're really close to them, we can hear and we can feel. There's an amazing transformation between you and that other person, and between you and the Father, and between you and your own identity that happens. So I think that's really interesting. Let's go in here and let's look at this book again. And I'm going to quote. We find examples of closeness setting off compassion in the Torah, such as when God responds to the people who have returned from waywardness and drawn close once again. In 2 Chronicles 30:9, we read, and I quote, "The Lord your God is gracious and compassionate. He will not turn his face from you if you return to him." The same process appears in Nehemiah 9:27. "When they were oppressed, they cried out to you. From heaven you heard them, and in your great compassion you gave them deliverers." Drawing close sets the stage for compassion. So it talks a lot about identifying with the other being the basis for compassion. And it says this, it says, "Identifying with the other as the basis for compassion is precisely what the Torah invokes when it hands down the commandment to be loving to the stranger in your midst. The rationale for doing so is our shared identity as strangers. You shall love the stranger because you have been strangers in the land of Egypt." Doesn't that lesson go a lot deeper than you think? That we as humans know what it feels like to be a rejected, lonely, lost stranger, and the streets are unfamiliar and everything you know is gone. It says here, aloofness, with its sense of being remote and distant, is inimical to compassion. So it is that a recent study of executioners in the United States documents that in order to do their job of killing people on behalf of the state, these people set an emotional gulf between themselves and the prisoner. And the closer they are to the killing, the article reports, the higher their level of disengagement goes. I think the same is true with doctors that do surgeries. I've heard people say, you know, different surgeons have a very poor bedside manner. They didn't come and talk to the patient and all that. I think this stands to reason. To me, this point that the book's making is validated through this, that the, how do you cut through, you had a doctor, he's a brain surgeon, and he said, I don't go and talk to the kids before I do brain surgery. I won't have my head in the game. I won't be focused. Because how do you actually saw open someone's skull and have just talked to them about their baseball game? You wear a different hat. There's a disengagement needed to do that job. I think we can understand that. There are times when we have to dial down all of that to be able to accomplish something. I think the military is an example of that. It's one of the things they need to kill a certain level of compassion in people so that a very difficult job can be done. But in our regular everyday lives, we need to dial the compassion up so that we can be connected. Because our goal is not to disconnect. And one of the things when people get out of the military that is so vital in their assimilating back into society is to help them learn to get back in touch with their compassion. That they did have to disengage from compassion for a certain amount of time, like in boot camp. I mean, they're just screaming at these recruits, and they're just screaming and screaming and screaming, and one person makes a mistake and everyone gets punished, and you really do lose your compassion for your fellow buddies on some level. There's still a brotherhood, I'll say, but this needs to be for the purposes of what they're doing in their mind, that they need to extinguish a lot of this and change people. So the idea is that when they come back and they're reassimilating into regular civilian life, they have to dial up the compassion. They can't remain in that place, or they'll have unsatisfying relationships that are disconnected and unfulfilling. So it's really, really important that we look at that for people that, you know, have served in the military. It's something to think about if you know people that are just trying to find their way back. You know, be a force for good in their life and help them to get in touch with their compassion. And don't judge them if they struggle with doing so. That's not going to help. It just makes it worse. Stand so close to them that you can hear. So that you can feel. So that you can feel their struggle with getting in touch with them. That's what's going to affect people, my friends, is when you stand close. I heard a pastor years ago at a church I attended when I was much, much, much younger. He said, don't think you can point people to Jesus from the curb. That's the way he worded it. And I never forgot that, because that is not how you do this. You stand close so that you can hear and that you can feel. That's how we are the light. That's how we are. The light shines on the people, not toward the people. So I really think the thread of compassion runs deep within all kinds of facets of just existence, of creation. It says here, and I'm going to look in the book again, we're going to read a little bit, talks about defining compassion, and I quote, "Compassion is a deep emotional feeling arising out of identification with the other that seeks a concrete expression," unquote. So there you have it. We have an idea that this is an expression and not just an emotion. And here's another thing the book says that I find interesting, and I quote, "Compassion flows between equals, or from the more powerful to the less powerful, as we see in the Torah, where it never expresses human feeling for God. It does, however, apply to a human king caring for subjects, and to God caring for humanity. These defining features help us understand what touches and moves people to act as they do when they manifest compassion," unquote. So it's talking about a benevolent God, right? A giving God who knows that we are the less powerful. We need his compassion. And we can have compassion for each other, but it's not so much that we're returning that back to God, that he isn't really needing our compassion. He is compassion. So simple, and yet so difficult. It says in this book, and I quote, Imitating the divine trait of compassion is not just a lovely ideal. We are assured that it is within our grasp to do so, however, because He will bestow upon you the attributes of compassion and show mercy to you. The capacity for compassion is innate within us, but to bring that quality from potential to actuality, we need to take steps to confront the obstacles to compassion. The book goes on to share about being the primary barrier being the separation we have between each other through ego and through judgment. These are boundaries and separations between each other. And it talks about this. It says, this was the practice of Rabbi Nosen Tzvi Finkel, the altar of Slabaka. His compassion emerged from his perception of the holy dimension of the person who stood before him. And here's what it says. He loved people with an extraordinary and excessive love, a love without restraints. He had a limitless affection for humanity, for any human, regardless of who or what he was. He was also extremely sensitive to any humiliation of any person, and he fully participated in another person's suffering. The source for these qualities is that he saw people, in people, the image of God, the part of God from above. Every human was, for him, like Adam, a creation of God's own hands before his sin and fall, whose holiness is part of the nature of every human, even after the sin, even after the sins of all later generations and all the terrible descents and falls. So the interplay of judgment and compassion, right, it's described very clearly in this book. It talks about the different varieties of compassion, the different forms of compassion. You know, there's enabling. Of course, you don't want to do that. But here's what I like. It says, ends the chapter on compassion. And here's what it says, and I quote, modeling our own pursuit of wholeness on the traits of God requires that we too need to be capable of acting in both ways, with compassion in the form of compassion and the compassion in the form of judgment. We aspire to having the spiritual dexterity to shift from one type of compassionate action to the other, as the situation requires and according to how our sensitivity guides us. We get a hint that our wise ancestors wanted us to grasp the multiple layers embedded in compassion, because the Hebrew term they bequeathed us, rachamim, is unique among the soul traits. Its name has no singular form and is always stated in the plural. Or possibly, they wanted us to understand that despite our apparent duality, compassion is one and so are we. And by Tomer Devereaux, I quote, one's compassion should extend to all creatures, and one should neither despise nor destroy them, for the wisdom above extends to all of creation, inanimate objects, plants, animals, and humans, unquote. So there you have the idea that this isn't about enabling. There is a time to call people out of what is bad for them that they're doing, that you know this, and to have wise discernment when you're holding space for people as opposed to calling people out. And that takes the Holy Spirit, that takes discernment, that takes wisdom and patience. And it takes relationship. It takes being in the trenches and in the foxhole with your friends and your family and your spouse. Walking this hard walk with them. Not being separate, but standing so close you can feel. It's not hard to maintain your own identity and still have compassion for others. We've just made it hard by too many self-help books about how we've done it wrong. There's an innate way, if we're using discernment, and if we trust the Torah to actually do this in a successful way, it can happen. Sometimes we need a little bit of unprogramming, right? We need to kind of be deprogrammed from a lot of the behaviors that we've kind of are like a slick veneer on us, and we don't even know where the seams are to tear that apart and to unlayer that, to take that you know, down one layer at a time. But I have found working in the field of compassion, which is what attachment's about, to be a very empowering field for me. I found it's helped me understand the Father. It's helped me understand the Torah. It's helped me understand myself and others. It's increased my connection with other people. That's not to say that I don't have my own methods of unhealthy coping. I tend to withdraw and isolate when I'm going through some things. And I don't always reach out as much as I should. But these are things I'm learning, you know, as I go. And I want people to be able to trust me. But I've definitely learned, you know, in many people's lives, as they share with me, that this is a common struggle. It's not just me. It's not just you. This is what people go through. And this is why compassion is such an important topic. And it's, like I said, it's one of the 13. And it's also, as I said, it's viewed as the thread, one of the threads of the fabric of the universe. We have a compassionate Father. The Most High God is compassionate. And we just got through Passover, and in our Haggadah, right? How many times does it say, "Oh, compassionate one, blessed be he," right? It's over and over we read this. Because that is one of his defining characteristics. It comprises who he is in partiality, right? It's who he is. And so I've really enjoyed talking about compassion, and I hope I've been able to convey to you the excitement that should be in your heart to look for opportunities to be compassionate and to act on this trait that's embedded in your being and to walk as the image of the Father, to walk in his image of compassion. And when you're reading the word, remember, there's clues to compassion everywhere. And don't forget to extend this compassion to yourself while always holding yourself to the highest standards. I've been really privileged to share this information with you today. I love this book, Everyday Holiness, and it really augments our Becky books. So I really have gotten a lot of good feedback about the spiritual path of Musar. And every time I bring a topic up, I get somebody saying, "Do that again," and archive them. So you can find Becky books at Amazon or on the authors pages. If you go to Amazon and you'll see who the authors are, you can go to their websites that are listed on their author page and buy them there or buy them on Amazon. But we also have the Becky book page, www.beckybook.com. And there's also a Facebook page. And on that, we have Becky Radio, which this program would be Becky Radio. And we archive a lot of the shows. Every now and then there might be a technology glitch and something didn't get recorded properly. But generally we try to, we've been better about it lately, getting those all up there. So that if you need to listen to this again or you want to share it with somebody else, that you can do so. But in the meantime, I'm just glad that we were together today and we talked about this. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope it really encouraged and inspired you. That's what I want. I want you to be encouraged, because our goal here at the Becky Book Show is to build and encourage the kingdom of Yeshua. And so that kingdom should be a united family with compassion. And that's how we're encouraged, and that's how we're built up. And so I'm very appreciative of your time today. Thank you for joining me on the Becky Book Show. I'm Dr. Robin Gould. If you want to reach me, you can reach me through my website, which is www.newcovenantpath.com. And I will respond to you. It might take a few days, but I will respond to you. So let me know what you think, or let me know things that you want covered on the Becky Book Show. I'm always looking for ideas. And we have guests coming up and in the past, and we'll continue to pursue the Becky Book authors and hear what they say, and especially as more Becky Books come out, because we have Becky Books added to the roster all the time. So until we meet again, I pray that you have a blessed week. I pray that you feel, experience, and give compassion in your life, and that it is abundant, because we are to live abundant lives. And the compassionate one has put you on the path to be there for people and to share your journey with them, because compassion is a two-way street. So I'm excited about it. It's exciting as a topic. And I do hope that you got something out of today. So hopefully you'll join us again next week where we'll cover another topic. Maybe we'll have a guest, maybe we'll have an author. But these are the things that I think matter and the things that I think transform our lives. So I thank you. I pray you have a blessed week, and we'll talk again soon. Shalom.